The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Thank you, Elliot. Thank goodness for Elliot. Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Carol Celine. Tonight, it is my pleasure to introduce both Jane Smiley and Patricia, or as I know her, Patty Marks. Before we get started, this is that official announcement. Turn off the cell phones, and thank you very much, everybody. No phones. That includes you, because yours went off at dinner. And I want to remind you that you're all invited to join us after the lecture for the book signing and the cookies in the lobby. Now, in the interest of full disclosure, I have to tell all of you that I learned tonight just before dinner that I am related through my former marriage to Patty Marks' mother's brother or uncle or something. However, since I'm no longer in that marriage, I think that doesn't count. In fact, I have to tell you that I never met Patty Marks before having dinner with her earlier this evening, but I feel like I have known her for years because her mother, Janice, is a good friend of someone I knew, who I think is here tonight, actually. And whenever I would run into Janice, she would launch into this long thing about her daughter, Patty. So, and I think maybe she thought because I was a writer and Patty was a writer that I would want to know about this. So first I heard all about how she was the first woman to ever write for the Harvard Crimson. Then it was her job on Saturday Night Live, for which I was incredibly jealous. And I used to watch and think, wonder if that's her skit. Wonder if that's her skit. Then it was that she was writing for Rugrats. I mean, it was like I knew her intimately. So when her byline started cropping up in national magazines like The New Yorker, I wasn't the least bit surprised, because when you have a Jewish mother like Janice, you are going to be successful. Patty did grow up in suburban Philadelphia in Abington. I asked her what they wrote about her in her yearbook, and she said, well, I was the editor, so I controlled that. She is considered one of the finest comic writers in the business today, so it's kind of hard to take her too seriously when she says, I write comedy because I'm too shallow to do anything else. Trust me, it is not easy to be funny, and she is very funny. Among her books are How to Regain Your Virginity, which I wish I had had when I first got divorced, Blockbuster, several children's books illustrated by the cartoonist Roz Chast, including Now Everybody Really Hates Me, and another book called Meet My Staff, which was the winner of the very prestigious Friedrich Medal. It's not striking a bell with any of you? Patty made up the award, and she named it after her air conditioner. Now, I haven't seen Janice for a while, so I really wasn't aware that Patty had made now her fiction debut with a book that she's going to talk about this evening. It's called Him, Her, Him Again, and the End of Him. It's a tongue-in-cheek comic novel about a directionless young woman's, she may not like me describing her that way, her romantic obsession with a lout of a self-centered boyfriend. And I just finished it, and in the course of reading it, I cannot tell you how many times my husband would turn to me and say, what is so funny? Patty's gift is writing humor, though, with just enough melancholy to seem that it's anchored in real life. And she did acknowledge tonight that she, like the character in the book, went to graduate school in London. But she and her mother both said that's where the truth ends. You can decide that if you get to read it. Now, I never met Jane Smiley's mother, so my attachment to her is far less personal. But her book, A Thousand Acres, ranks for me as one of the most compelling emotional novels I have ever read. And I vividly remember when I finished it several years ago. It was about 12:30 at night. And I was so agitated and excited and moved, I couldn't go to sleep. And I was desperate to talk to somebody about it. Well, you can't call your friends at 12:30. Fortunately, my daughter, who lived in California and had recommended the book to me, was on 9:30 time, 12:30 here, so I called her, and she very patiently talked to me for about an hour until I was calm enough to finally go to sleep. So I want to thank Jane Smiley for her glorious ability to capture the pain and the joy of family relationships. A Thousand Acres, which was loosely inspired by Shakespeare's King Lear, received the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction in 1992, and Jane told a cute story at dinner about how someone from a paper called and said, "What if you won the Pulitzer Prize? What would you say?" And she said something, you know, I guess appropriate, and then she mentioned to one of her daughters that she thinks she may have won the Pulitzer Prize, and the daughter typically said, "Oh, that's cool," and that was the end of that. The book was adapted into a 1997 film of the same title. In total, Jane Smiley is the author of more than 10 novels, as well as 4 works of nonfiction. Her first novel, Barn Blind, was published in 1980, and in 1985 she won the O. Henry Award for her short story, Lily. She graduated from Vassar College. She spent a year studying in Iceland as a Fulbright scholar, and I meant to ask you why, but maybe you'll tell us tonight because I never did. She earned her PhD from the University of Iowa, where she once taught. She now lives in California with her partner, Jack Canning, who is a former Philadelphian. And if any of you are from South Philadelphia, you may remember his father's butcher shop, which had sawdust on the floor. I want to give you some random facts about Jane that I gleaned at dinner, which I found just gave me more of a sense of who she was. For those of you who have read her book, Horse Heaven, which was her favorite book, she's been riding horses. She was a kid, and she admits that today she is a horse degenerate, although most people don't use that term. Her mother was a journalist, and she said she wore wonderful clothes when she went to work. And while most mothers of that era would encourage their daughters to find a man and get a husband, her mother encouraged her to be a writer because she said it was the best life that you could have. Jane has 5 children, 3 of her own and 2 that are stepchildren. I asked her if she found a writer's life lonely, and she said no, because you always have the company of all your characters. She tries to write at least 3 pages every day, and she does not read reviews. In middle school, a report card said, "She only does what she wants to do." And Jane said, "That's pretty much the story of my life." She describes herself as incessantly inquisitive, and it will come as no surprise to those of you who are going to read her new book, which I recommend, 10 Days, that she was 3 times listed in Best Erotica in America, a little known fact. Miss Smiley has also won acclaim for her work as an author of short fiction, The Age of Grief, Stories and a Novella, Ordinary Love and Goodwill, 2 novellas, The Life of the Body, A Story, and numerous uncollected short stories. Smiley writes about the complex, often secret emotional dynamics that underlie human relationships. At the heart of her fiction is a belief that there are answers, sometimes bitter, even grievous, to the questions that afflict all human beings. Time Magazine, now you didn't read this review, so I'm going to quote it for you. No, I'm only going to say the good stuff. Time Magazine describes her new novel, 10 Days in the Hills, as a marathon of beguiling talk, both personal and political, and explicit sex. I'm reading it now, and I can attest to the fact that the explicit sex is again keeping me up at night. 10 Days takes its structure from Boccaccio's The Decameron, which was written in the 14th century, and a kind of a gab fest of food and wine and ramblings that was set in the Tuscan countryside during the plague. Miss Smiley has moved the locale to Los Angeles. She substitutes the war in Iraq for the Black Death. Some will find that totally appropriate. And the book takes its spirit from the Kama Sutra, and it draws its satirical humor from, this is me, not time. It draws its satirical humor from the self-centered, rich and trendy culture of the movies. This is a big, smart, bawdy riff of a book written by a masterful storyteller. It is my pleasure to welcome to the library tonight both Jane Smiley and Patricia, or as we who know her now call her Patty, Marks. And Patty will be our first reader.
Thank you, Cousin Carol. Listening to your introduction embarrassed me a lot. You didn't embarrass me. My mother embarrassed me. But I was sort of digging around a stack of papers because I'm going to get back at her right now. This isn't how I was going to begin, but I'm going to begin. A friend of mine a few weeks ago called me and said, could I interview you for the Huffington Post? And I said, sure, about your book. And the next day she called back and she said, I'm not going to interview you. Could I interview your mother? And I said, well, yeah, she's not really going to want to do that. And my friend said, I know exactly how to get her. And I said, what are you going to do? She's going to say, I'm going to tell her it's going to sell a lot of books. So it worked. And I'm going to read you the interview that my friend Cynthia did with my mother. Hello, Mrs. Marks. I guess congratulations are in order, my mother. Call me Janice. Everyone does. Okay, Janice, how many times have you read your daughter's book? Janice, 3 times. The first time I loved it. The second time I loved it. By the third time I hated Eugene, who's the villain of the book. How do you like the character of the mother? Well, she says, yeah, yeah, I would never say that. And the father says, Jesus Christ, Patty's father never said that. All I can say is my mother never did say, yeah, yeah. My mother would say, yes, yes. My mother is someone who keeps a notebook of how many times the people on television make grammatical errors. Generally, what do you think of it? My mother. Well, as a friend of mine said, it reads like a novel. This is like a let me just add that as a novelist, that's exactly what you strive for in a novel. Exactly. As the author's mother, was it your job to correct grammar and spelling? Her grammar is pretty good, but there are always errors. I saw one after it was printed, probably a who or a whom thing. I never told her. Read my book and look for the who or whom thing. Where am I? My mother, unsolicited, I might add. Do you want me to tell you what I told her to change? Cynthia. Sure. I told her to change the name Aunt Sugar. That's a stupid name. I told her to make Uncle Walt a dentist. I don't want a podiatrist in the family. And she said that Grandma was born in Bulgaria. My mother was born in this country. I told her to change that right away. It's fiction, Mrs. Marks. Whatever. There are some pretty big words in there. Does Patty really know what dendrochronological, I don't know how to pronounce it, abecedarian and threnodus mean? Probably. I have to interrupt by saying that I got an email from, of all people, another review I love, from my dermatologist saying, I read your book, I love it, I didn't know you knew so many big words. Some of the words I looked up, the other ones I made up a meaning for. For years, Patty couldn't write anything longer than a paragraph, and then this comes out, 75,000 words. How did she do it? I have no idea. When you read the book, it really is Patty, though. And then again, my mother, unsolicited, did you see the People magazine review with a beautiful half-page picture of her? I spent $4 on it. Blah, 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 blah. The mother in the book often gives the daughter how to succeed in life rules like, quote, anybody who's anybody has cuffs on their pants. My mother. That's Patty. She made that up. Is it true that you made your son sit in front of Brooks Brothers to prove that all the successful guys leaving the store had cuffs on their pants? Patty says he pointed to one well-dressed guy without cuffs, and you said, yeah, well, that guy is not going anywhere. My mother. Well, I did get excited about cuffs. Blah, 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 blah. Has there been a lot of talk among your friends about the book? I told Patty to put my hairdresser in the book. She did, Nino at the Philadelphian. He's very good. On page 213. He photocopied his page, taped it up, and discusses it with everyone who comes in. I think he laminated it, too. I'm not sure. Nally thinks he's a celebrity. What did you think of her outfit at the book party? I thought it was sensational, incredible, not that she's ever had a bad outfit. She looked beautiful. Who should play Patty when they make it into a movie? My mother. Yeah, right. Not yes, right. Yeah, right. It might become a movie, and Patty told me that she wanted Reese Witherspoon to play her, which I don't anymore. Absolutely not. Reese Witherspoon's chin is too big, and Patty's dark. Who should play you? I am the mother of the book, not the mother in the book, which is true. But if I have to cast that mother in the book, Reese Witherspoon, of course. Now, I did this terrible thing because I took a watch out, and I was like, 15 minutes exactly, but I don't know when I started, so I'm just going to go on for a little while longer. And I do want to say, and I was going to begin by saying that I am so, so honored to be sharing a stage, not this second, but I will be sharing a stage, with Jane Smiley, who's a big hero of mine, and I feel really, with one book now, that I have been picked to be an alternate on junior varsity, and Jane is like captain of varsity, so I'm really, really excited. And I think this is a terrible way to introduce my reading, but I'm just going to, because I usually hate reading so much, I'm going to do my imitation of a reading. First they had the fumble for the glasses. Fumble for the glasses. And then they take about 3 hours to find the passage. And then they say, I'm going to read a short passage from page 47 to 1,328. But before I do, I need to explain a few things you need to understand so that you'll know what I'm reading. First, I'd like to detail the lineage of every character in my book, dating back to the age of the Australopithecus. And also, I need to tell you every single thing about medieval heraldry. And then I'm going to give you an advanced course in particle physics. And even though they told me to read for a short amount of time, I'm going to read for a long amount of time because I love the way I sound. I'm going to intone extremely slowly. in a droning nasal voice, which I love. Or maybe I'll talk in a sing-song voice, as if I'm reading a bedtime story to a child. Anyway, I hardly have time to read, so it's accomplished. So I'm going to read a tiny little bit, but, you know, as I say at the doctor's office, you'll just feel a little discomfort, and then it will be over. I was going to read a different part, but since the theme is embarrassing my mother, I'm going to read from chapter 6, and it had nothing to do with my parents. The protagonist, the narrator, has just gotten a job at a show called Tape But Proud, which I always forget, and called Tape But Loud. And it's her first day, and she's nervous, and she calls her parents. And that's not really where I began. Okay. You have to help me, I said in a snivel to my mother over the phone. It was 1:30 in the morning, and I was in my office at Tape But Proud, having been on the job for not even 4 whole days. I'm supposed to write a sketch by tomorrow about Belarus. I wiped away tears with my sleeve. And it has to be funny. A sketch about Belarus, my mother said. They tortured a journalist because he was criticizing the government, I said. A sketch about that. It has to be topical. Well, let's see, my mother said. Belarus has a very poor human rights record. I know that, I said with a sigh. But can you think of something funny about that situation? My mother didn't say anything. There was also a siege on an orphanage in Belarus. A few children were killed. It could be about that, I said, as if I were being helpful. But it still has to be really, really, really funny. Hold on, my mother said, putting the phone down. Wake up, I heard her say in the background. We have to write a sketch about Belarus. Belarus? I heard my father say to my mother in a groggy voice. What about Belarus? Something funny about the situation there, my mother said. It has to be topical. What time is it? I heard my father say. Here, I heard my mother say, you talk to her. Let me get this straight, my father said to me. You have to write something about Belarus? I need at least 3 pages, I said. Wait a minute, my father said. I can't think unless I'm dressed. My mother picked up the phone. Isn't there someone at the show who could help you? She said. No, I mean, yes, I said, but I can't ask anyone anything. They think I know how to write. I tricked them. You're a very good writer, my mother said. First my thesis, now this. She didn't write her thesis in the first part of the book. Okay, my mother said. What if, don't worry. Wait, I just thought of something. My mother must have pressed the button on the intercom because I heard a low-pitched tone. In my parents' new house, there was an intercom in every room. Mother, I heard my mother say. My grandmother was staying with my parents for a few weeks. Are you up? My mother said. Mother, wake up. We're going to meet in the den to write a sketch about the old country for Tape But Proud. Grandma doesn't know how to write a sketch, I said. Yes, but her mother's from Romania and she's awake, my mother said. We'll call you back in a little while. I'll stop there. Thank you.
I'm almost afraid to begin. I'm going to read from day 5, Friday, March 28th, 2003. The characters in this section, 10 Days in the Hills, has 10 characters and 5 men, 5 women. And the characters in this section are Stoney, whose father was a legendary Hollywood agent, who is about 37, and Isabel, whose father is a director who owns the house where they're staying. And she is 23. At some point, they refer to her mother, Zoe, who's an actress, and her grandmother, Delphine, who lives in the guest house of her father's house. They are sitting around the pool. It's late at night. And I guess the one thing you should know is that Stoney has been visiting Isabel in her bedroom since she was about 16, but she doesn't actually think of him as a boyfriend. He never rose to that level in her estimation. Anyway, Stoney and Isabel were lying on chaise longues at the farthest edge of the pool, under the shadow of the hillside in the dark. Isabel suspected that it was way after midnight already. Even the pool light was out, and the water was black and invisible. If she had been making the movie of this conversation, Isabel thought, she would have stippled in some stars in the calm, liquid surface of the pool and had them dimly reflect the stars in the sky. She said, "Stoney, do you think that when you're in a hole the way we are here, you can see more stars, or is that just an illusion?" "I have no idea." It was cool, and she was lying on a blanket covered with towels. Their edges and corners fluttered just a little bit. It had been an odd day, hot and windy. Now she could feel the wind eddy about. The ridgeline to the west protected them from direct exposure. Even so, she had more of a sense than usual of something dangerous out and about. Only the wind, but still. So she had a towel wrapped around her head. It was warm and comforting to be so cocooned. Stoney said, "I met with those Russians this morning. They told a story. I've been thinking about it all day." "What was it?" "Well, they're staying at the Beverly Wilshire, so we were sitting in the restaurant there. Did I tell you before that their names are Mike, Al, and Sergey? Mike is the boss. When he got up to go buy some cigars, Al leaned across the table to Sergey and said, 'Do you know how Mike got married?' Sergey shakes his head, and Al glances at me and says, 'You know, Mike is from Kazan, which is almost not Russia. He lives in Moscow now, but he went back to his home district when he was ready to get married and fell for this girl, Adana. But she was determined to finish at the university and have a career, so she turned him down and ran off and hid from him. He tried to set up a deal with her parents, but she still wouldn't have it. One day, Mike is out wandering in the countryside trying to figure out what to do about Adana. Should he forget her? Should he try something else? Why is she such a cold bitch? And he hears the sound of dogs barking and howling, and he turns around, and here comes a naked girl. The dogs are big wolfhound types, and they're chasing her. Behind them is a man on a horse with a gun. The dogs run her down and grab her, and the guy jumps off his horse and goes after her with his gun. Mike has a gun, too, like he always does. So he steps in among the dogs and shoots one and grabs the girl. She's got blood pouring from her belly and her breasts, so Mike holds him off, but thinking that the guy looks familiar. And then the guy says, 'Mike, it's not your business.' But Mike won't let him near her. She's crying. One of the dogs is dead. Mike figures it's going to be a shootout, which isn't so uncommon in Kazan. But the guy says that he's Mike's uncle Nikolai and that this is Masha that he's in love with. Now, Mike's uncle is dead, and he figures the guy is lying, so he threatens to shoot the other dog. The uncle says that, yes, he did die, but unbeknownst to the family, he died by his own hand out of love for the girl. And after he died, the girl Masha laughed and gloated at his funeral. But then Masha died of a mysterious illness." Stoney sat up, leaned toward her, and whispered, "After her death, the two of them were sent to hell and were cursed. And their curse is this. Once a week, just at sunset on Friday, he chases her with the dogs right to this spot. The dogs catch her. And he shoots her." Isabel said, "Stoney, do you believe everything you hear?" And suddenly, as the uncle finishes telling the story, the dead dog leaps up and sinks his teeth into the girl's ass, and she screams. Mike steps back in surprise. The uncle shoots the girl in the head. pulls out a knife, slits her open, pulls out her heart, which is small and hard, and throws it to the dogs who gobble it down, and then all of them, dogs, horse, uncle, and girl, vanish. He sat back out of her gaze, and Isabel looked up at the stars again. She said, "This is a ghost story, right? They say it really happened." "Ugh," said Isabel. It was true, she thought, that honoring the integrity of other people's cultures was always harder than you thought it was going to be. The next week, according to Al, Mike talks Adana and her family into going with him and his family out to this spot. Pretty soon, they're ensconced under some trees, and here comes the horse, the uncle, the girl, and the dogs. She is naked and running and screaming and as live and palpable as you or me. The horse is churning up dust, and the dogs are barking and baying right in front of the spectators. They leap on her and bring her down and begin tearing her apart. Nikolai jumps off his horse and wades into the melee and does the same thing as the week before, shoots her in the head so that her brains spatter all over a nearby tree, and then he rips her open, tears out her little tiny heart, throws it to the dogs, and they all disappear into thin air. Adana's father runs over to the tree and sees that the bark is clean, no blood, no hoof prints, no sign of a bullet. Well, the onlookers are really shook by this. It's 1992, after all, and all the old folks went to Soviet-era schools, and nothing about this sort of thing was ever covered in the curriculum. They do believe in curses, though, so the mother and the father take the daughter aside, and they have a long family conference right there, and Mike starts looking a little better to her. Everyone decides in the end that the marriage could be good or bad, but a curse is worse, and so they have a wedding. And Mike brings Adana back to Moscow, and now she works for Itar Tass, and they have a couple of kids. "They told you this with a straight face?" Stoney nodded. "This girl is my age? 30, actually." Isabel shivered, looked up at the stars, and listened for the low whoosh of cars on the unseen 405. "They told you this sitting in the restaurant at the Beverly Wilshire?" "Yeah." "Did Masha feel the pain?" "I gather that's what a curse is. You have to feel the pain." "I guess." Now Isabel could feel the darkness form a second layer of her cocoon. It gathered around her, pressing quietly against her. It was L.A. darkness, reassuring after all, darkness that wafted around places like the Beverly Wilshire and Rodeo Drive and Sunset, up Beverly Glen to Mulholland, along the PCH, feathered by the whiteness of the breaking surf. Darkness in L.A. wasn't all that dark in Isabel's experience, and was anyway always broken up and scattered by light. It sounded like darkness in Russia was deeper and more dangerous. Adana and Masha, she shivered. He said, "The way the family interpreted the curse was that the girl returned evil for good. When the guy gave her his love, she not only spurned him, she mocked him." "So," said Isabel, "she had no right to her own thoughts and feelings, basically." "For her to have her own thoughts and feelings is a danger to the entire town. Is that what they are saying?" "Basically, yeah." "So what does this have to do with my father?" Stoney said, "Nothing, except that Mike's the boss and the one with the money. He came back without any cigars and said he didn't like what they had, but I kept wondering if they'd set me up with this story to communicate something." "Well, that sounds very godfatherish." "I admit that, but you know what they say about movie critics." "What?" "After they've seen 3 movies a day for a year, they hardly dare to go down the basement steps anymore." Isabel snuggled down into her cocoon and pulled her turban over her eyes so that she couldn't see anything. But she knew Stoney was looking at her, so she smiled. She heard him go on. "I mean, it's not like threats and intimidation are unheard of in Hollywood. Bugsy Siegel, Frank Sinatra, William Randolph Hearst, George Raft and all that. You know who Anthony Pelicano is, right? I mean, it's still happening. If Jerry were alive, he would know how to talk to them." "What did you say?" "I said I'd schedule a meeting." Then I came out onto Rodeo Drive, and it was so windy that the trees were cracking. It was kind of apocalyptic. Your dad was a tough guy, wasn't he? Said Isabel. Jerry had been a fixture in Isabel's life, but she had never experienced him at all the way Stoney had, no doubt because she was a girl. Jerry treated all females the same way. He complimented their clothes and hair, brought presents, asked them jovially if they had any boyfriends, and then, more or less, ignored them. Well, compared to whom? Compared to De Niro in The Godfather Part 2? Did he do what he had to do when he was a kid? Compared to Pacino in The Godfather Part 3? Did he allow the deaths of longtime friends and associates because they'd betrayed the code or gotten in the way? I sincerely doubt it. But he was fearless in some ways. He was so intent on the goal that his mind didn't take in threats the way mine does. A threat for Jerry was just another factor to be considered while he was deciding his strategy. In the end, people always did what Jerry wanted them to do. Even when he had that brain tumor, he was still like the Terminator. You just couldn't stop him. He was tough like that. Isabel pushed up her towel and then turned her head and looked at Stoney. Her eyes were so adjusted to the dark now that she could see him perfectly. To all appearances, she thought, he was just talking. With Stoney, though, just talking inevitably seemed to circle around to Jerry. All the same, she didn't like the idea of her father being vulnerable to these Russian guys, whoever they were, with only Stoney as protection. She said, hopefully, I guess my dad is a pretty tough negotiator. Max isn't a negotiator at all. That's his problem. What do you mean? Well, if he really wants to do something, then he will give up anything in order to do it. I mean, when he made Southern Pacific, remember that one? Oh, with Dennis Quaid, I'd love that one. Well, you and one movie reviewer, I think. Well, anyway, Max loved that script, and he wanted to work with that cinematographer, and then he had Dennis all fired up, and Jerry had to practically lock him in the closet to keep him from giving everything away. He would have done it for PBS. He would have spent his own money to do it. He thought that his enthusiasm meant something good. But all it meant to the studio was that they could roll right over him. If they get it cheap, then the project just doesn't mean anything to them. That's the way their minds work. And Max should have known that. If you don't play hard to get in this town, then nothing about your project has any value. But if Max is not interested in a project, he just says no, and then he gets pissed when they keep after him. No means no, said Isabel. I can't tell you how many times I've heard that over the years. Well, in this business, no means call me later and come up with more money. He should know that by now. Your mom is a great negotiator. She's legendary. You're kidding. Nope. You know that way she has of reacting to what you say with something that's just a little out of left field, and then you laugh, but you aren't sure she was really making a joke? Yes, it's because she isn't really listening. Well, I don't know why it is, but it's always disarming because all the guys in the room are thinking about one thing, and she's not thinking about that thing. And then she seems truly not to care about any project more than any other. They think they have to make her care, and of course they think the way to do that is money and perks and points and stuff. But she doesn't really seem to care about that either, so they offer more. Maybe she's a great actress in those negotiations, but, in fact, I think she really doesn't care. I don't know what she does care about, said Isabel. And saying it felt like a confession. I don't know who she cares about. There were several things she could add, Isabel thought, but she resisted doing so. Stoney said, are we going to talk about her failures as a mother? We could, but I know what you think, and I know what you think. How about you tell me what I think, and I'll tell you what you think, and we'll see if we still agree with ourselves. Isabel sniffed, knowing he was making fun of her, but yes, she did deserve to be made fun of, at least a little. So she said, you think she's afraid of me, and just because whenever she calls me or talks to me, I act snotty, she gets more afraid of me and less interested, less likely to make an effort. Stoney said, you think that she's a selfish narcissist who should take more of an interest in others who are not unsuitable men, that there has actually only been one suitable man, that would be Max, And in the end, pleasing him meant fulfilling her obligations to you and Delphine, and that was the deal killer for her. Isabel looked at the stars again for a moment, then wiggled around in her cocoon, which suddenly felt too tight. She said, "I guess we understand each other, if you say so. Our analysis doesn't go very deep." "I don't think it does, no." "Well, you know what Delphine told me once?" "I don't know." "Oh, I was a senior in high school, I guess, and I was sitting on my bed ranting on about the legendary Zoe Cunningham, and Delphine was picking up my dirty clothes, and yes, I am fully aware what a selfish baby I was being, and anyway," she said, "your mom is who she is because I bred her." "What does that mean?" "That's what I said. And so Delphine sat down on the edge of the bed, and she told me about her life. I have never told anyone this story, not even those girls at college who were dying for a comeuppance." "Okay. You know she was born in Jamaica, right?" "Yes." "Well, she's never been back there." She said, "Honey, Jamaica was just one piece of bad luck after another for me, and I turned my back on that place, and I turned my back on that bad luck. I guess when she was 3, there was a tremendous flood in Kingston, and it destroyed their house, and her older brother, who was 5 or so, and her mother and the baby, who was just born, were all killed. Only Delphine and her father survived, and he lost everything, so that he had to go to work on a sugar plantation out in the country, repairing engines and cars and things like that. She never saw him again for more than a visit. She stayed in Kingston with her mother's cousin. I guess she was nice enough, but of course, Delphine had lost her entire family." "Well, yeah, isn't that sad?" They were silent for a few moments, and Isabel suspected that Stoney was thinking of his own mother's death, and yes, here she was, whining about Zoe to someone who had much more to whine about on that score, but who never whined, and indeed, never even mentioned his mother. And so she was embarrassed, but she saw that it would be more awkward and therefore more embarrassing to stop telling her story, so she shifted it a little. "Anyway, she was sent to school. It was an English-type school where they had to wear uniforms and speak only when spoken to, and basically it was right out of Jane Eyre, but for Jamaicans. She was being trained to do something useful, if only to be a high-class servant. Here's what I remember about that school, honey. I remember that I was not pretty and that I would never be pretty. I was too tall and too skinny, and I had big teeth, and my uniform never fit about the waist. In an English school, they always tell you what's wrong with you. And between you and me, that's not all bad, because then you can make a plan and you know how the world works. And for Jamaican girls, the world works in one way for pretty girls and another way for plain girls, and that's just the way it is. I don't say they were mean to me. I say they had a job to make me know myself, and that's what they did." "I mean, really, Stoney, this story is so sad that if I thought about it, I wouldn't know how to handle it. But I don't think about it much. I look at her, and she seems healthy and self-reliant, and so I just try to think of it as the adventures of Delphine. Anyway, when she got out of school right after the war, she went to work for a rich woman as her assistant, and she did that for maybe 2 years, and then she fell in love with the chauffeur, and they did all the right things. They waited to get married until they had some money, and when they did get married, she was something like 23 or 24, and her employer was very fond of her, and they got their own little house on the property, and right away they had a baby girl, and she said, I looked at her, and I saw she just looked exactly like me, honey, and my heart sank inside me. Then the employer got polio, and that whole family took their money and went back to England. And the new owners of the place fired out everyone for political agitation because Delphine's husband was a leftist. There wasn't any work, so the husband went off to England looking for a job in the mid-50s. And Delphine waited to hear from him because either he was going to come back or she was going to join him. But they didn't hear from him. And then the baby, who was about 4 by that time, died in a hurricane when the wall of the house they were sheltering in fell on her while she was sleeping. And then a man came from England and told her that her husband had been killed by hooligans on the street, almost as soon as he arrived in London. So she said to me, that was enough Jamaica for me. No more floods, no more hurricanes, no more English people. I went around to everyone I knew and asked for some money, and because everyone felt sorry for me, they all gave me a little. And so I got to Miami Beach, where I worked as a maid in the fanciest hotel there, which I guess was called the Eden something. Eden Rock, said Stoney. It was very famous. And that's what happened before this happened. So thank you for having us. And we're happy to answer questions.
Well, I'm Elliot Shelkrut, president of the library, and I have the honor of kind of fielding these questions. And we have, as many of you know, as customary, we have volunteers on the aisles with microphones, and we'd like you to raise your hand. You may ask a question of one or the other or both of our guests today. So please raise your hand, and we'll get started.
You know, I taught freshman English for a really long time, so I never hesitate to call on the audience if no one raises
their
hand.
There you go. Let's have
3, 2, 1. I guess it's going to have to be you.
Oh, yeah. There we go. Okay. Raise your hand high so we can get the person with the microphone can see. Go ahead.
Patty.
My social security number. I know it.
That was a great reading. And do you do that all the time, or is this special for us?
Special for you. Completely special for you. I wrote the book for you alone. You know what? I'm an ADD listener, so I always keep the ADD reader and listener in mind. I do a reading.
That was really great. Thanks.
Okay. There's another person right on my left there.
I know why I went to Iceland, but why did you?
I went to Iceland because I had taken 5 semesters of graduate school in the Icelandic sagas. And I thought I was going to go to Iceland and do a dissertation in Icelandic. But then I got to Iceland and I discovered, A, I couldn't stay awake, and B, a woman they were talking about had recently died, who'd spent her entire career in Icelandic studies. When they went to find her great masterwork, they opened her filing cabinets and found only empty liquor bottles. And I said, I don't know that I can go in that direction. So I started writing a novel there. It never got published. But Iceland was where I learned about medieval Greenland. And that was a novel that I really loved and enjoyed working on for many years. So I got a lot out of Iceland.
I thought the question was for me. And the answer was going to be sweaters.
Okay, yes, right here, please.
For Jane, I really admire your work. And how much of an autobiographical component is in your novels?
Hardly any at all. She asked about the autobiographical component. I wrote a novel a long time ago called At Paradise Gate, which was about 60% about my mother and two of her sisters and my grandparents. But they really weren't that interesting, so I also collected a lot of other stories from other people and included that in the novel. I'm not really a autobiographical person. My own life sort of bores me. But I'm, as I said at dinner, I'm very inquisitive, and as soon as I learn stuff, I write it down. So be careful.
Great. Right in the middle. Wait, now let's get the microphone there. Make it, you know.
in reading your range from Greenlanders to duplicate keys to 1,000 acres, sometimes I've wondered if you just keep stretching and trying your hand at anything and if you've written any sonnets.
I did write a sonnet once. In college, I wrote a sonnet.
Do you consciously make an effort to just go in a direction that you haven't been before to see if you can get there?
No, I'm easily bored. Mm-hmm. You know, I love the form of the novel. Those of you who may have read 13 Ways of Looking at the Novel would know that I really love novels, and I think they're kind of an incomprehensible and endless treasure. But every novel is imperfect. Every novel, you have to make compromises in every novel. And for me, to write a funny novel, say, the compromise is that it's not serious. And so by the time I'm finished with the funny one, I'm sort of thinking, you know, I really would like to write something tragic or heartbreaking. But then by the time I'm finished with the tragic or heartbreaking one, I'm missing what was maybe in a different, more realistic style. So it's not a conscious stretching, but it's more like an inability to stick with the same thing. And I'm lucky the novel is of such a rich form. I would be hard put to write, political exposés year after year after year. But, you know, I think that's a good question for Patty, too, because you've tried lots of forms and done lots of different things. I'd love to hear about that.
Well, first of all, I when I try heartbreaking and tragic, it just comes out funny, so I'm left with that. And I've written children's books, and I've written TV, and I've written movies, and I always find it. People say, doesn't it compromise your writing when you write for TV? And I find writing is writing. It always sort of is entertainment for me. And I'm not very good at plot, which is really not a good thing not to be good at when you're writing movies, I've discovered. But I hardly even understand plots. And even when I'm writing a plot, I'm thinking, no, wait, how did that happen? So I'm left with characters and stuff, and I like you try to change what I do the next time, but it just is like a different way of saying the same thing. And so I'm writing a second novel, and I decided that I would be really brave and not write first person, and it's hard for me as a narcissist not write first person. It's really, really hard. Because, you know, I'm the person on stage all the time. But so I try to shift it. I even forget what the question is, but I've talked long enough.
It was a good answer anyway.
Okay. Good answer.
Please, let's raise the other questions. Okay, moving. All right, we have the gentleman over on the left first, and then we'll go to you, sir.
Okay, I was just wondering about, like, if you said you get your story ideas sometimes from other people, or like little bits you write down. Has that ever come back to, like, bite you in the ass?
Oh, absolutely.
Are there any good?
I've told this story a couple times in the last couple of days, but a long time ago I had a story in The Atlantic that was based on the brother of a friend of mine whom I'd never met. He lived somewhere else, and he was, as you can imagine, if those of you read my pieces on the Huffington Post, he was my favorite victim, a right-wing think tanker. And so I wrote a story about him, including him, or rather, and also including another guy that I had met, who I dated briefly. And so a lot of bad things happened from this story. The thing that happened with the right-wing think tanker was he was coming out of his church one day, and his pastor shook his hand and said, "Do you know Jane Smiley?" And he said, "No, but my sister does." And the pastor said, "Well, you better look in this month's Atlantic, because I think there's a story about you in there." And he called his sister after reading the story, and he said, "Have you been talking to me about to Jane Smiley about me, and I, or his sister said, "Oh God, no! I would never do such a thing." So it must have been psychic on my part. In the meantime, the other guy that I put in the story, he never spoke to me again. But I didn't learn any lessons from that, I have to say.
I lived with a friend of mine and her husband for a while, and she was a writer and I was a writer, and every time any of us would talk, either she or I would say, "And this is mine, I'm going to take this." or he would say, "I'm going to say something and I don't want it to appear in print."
I wrote an essay once for a book, an anthology called "Can Writers Have Friends?" And the answer was no.
But a friend of mine said, "You can really write anything about anyone if you preface it by saying, 'So-and-so, a very attractive man.'"
I will say that I trained my children early to understand what their bread and butter was. And so although they may have felt angry over the years, they never let on. So they've been good about it.
Okay. We have the gentleman here.
I want to ask a question of Ms. Smiley that probably will not evoke a funny answer. And that is regarding 1,000 Acres. What was there about Lear that made you choose that out of the Shakespeare opus as a source of your story?
Well, I had to read King Lear quite a few times, first in high school, then in college, then in graduate school. And every time I came to that scene where Goneril and Regan are talking about the rioting knights the night before, and they're complaining, they've made the mess, and you can imagine the mess. They broke the tables, the dogs ate all the food, everybody was vomiting, probably people got hurt. And Goneril and Regan talk about whether Lear should have 100 knights living with him now that they don't have anything to do. And I was always on their side. You know, when Regan finally said, "Well, what need one?" I didn't see that as a mean thing for her to say. I saw it as a practical thing for her to say. And so I felt that there was another point of view with regard to this play about who Lear was and what his rights as a person were compared to theirs. And that stuck in my mind for a long time. And then one day in the late 80s, I'd been thinking about this. And I'd been thinking about it sort of as a production of King Lear in the Tom Stoppard tradition. You know, we would rewrite it and do it as a production. But then we were driving from Minneapolis to Ames, Iowa, in about March, and it was a hideous, horrible, gray, desolate, windy plains day. And I said, "I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to set that King Lear book here." And as so often happens, I think, with novelists, all of the ideas suddenly went bam and came together. And then I wrote out of that moment of realization that I could set my production of King Lear on a farm and in Iowa, and I could talk about issues that had also been on my mind since I'd been living in Iowa, namely agricultural pollution and agricultural issues that hadn't in the previously been related to Lear, but now they were. How about you?
Let's see, another question? Okay, right here.
This is for both of you. When you're writing a novel, do you know how it's going to end when you started it, or is it sort of a free-flowing thing?
I wondered about this.
Okay,
book with
I have
you
an answer
then.
To that. I love the question when I'm writing a novel. Having written one, let me think about all that. I did something different than I'd ever done before when we wrote this. I always know exactly where I'm going
when I write a piece and of anything, even, you know, a grocery list, I know where it's going to end. And a friend of mine who's an editor said, don't do that. Completely don't know where you're going. And so for the first time, I didn't know where I was going, which was scary but easy because you don't have to do the outline. And in fact, this is a friend of mine who's an editor, and I would read him every day what I had written the night before. And I said, I think I know how it's going to end. And he said, don't even say it, because then you might end it that way. So I was completely without a map, which I liked. And would do it again because it's a lazier way to go, too.
I would agree with that. Mm-hmm. For me, it's been, I've used a lot of different forms. And so, for example, with a murder mystery, you really have to know what the plot is going to be. But some of the novels, and if you're making up a novel around King Lear, you have to read the play. And I did find that if I deviated from the play, I would get really lost in the wilderness, and I had to go back and figure out where I deviated. And he really did know what he was doing when he constructed that play. And so I had to follow him as my guide. But other novels have been looser. And Horse Heaven, for example, I had no idea where that was going. And I enjoyed that, too. This one I had no real idea, but I knew they were going to have to leave at some point, that probably after 10 days. So I had an idea of the structure and the boundaries, but I didn't really have an idea about the story.
Okay. We have time for one more question before we go upstairs. There we go, towards the back on my left side with the orange and gray jacket. Right, okay.
Is either of you interested in licensing a story or a few stories?
In what?
You mentioned that you are both look for stories, and friends, whoever, say, around you, when they talk about something, you grab onto it and write about something. And I'm just curious if I'm being funny, or at least attempting to be funny.
Oh, and licensing. That's what licensing, she said.
Yeah.
Licensing.
Oh, licensing. By the time it got to this, it wasn't that word.
That's a new idea. We should think about that. You know, what happens with me is I don't realize that I'm about to hear a story. Henry James had, I sympathize with Henry James in some ways. And one of the things he said was that he would hear something and then, like a little seed of a story, it could be a word, it could be a tiny little incident, it could be just a detail. And then he would close his ears. He didn't want to know what really happened, because he felt in himself a kind of sudden proliferation and blossoming of developments. And I feel that way, too. I think once you've been writing stories for a long time, two or three details and you've got practically a novel. And but I'm still very inquisitive, and I do love to eavesdrop, spy on people, pick up the telephone when other people are talking, gossip, and I guess that's enough. That's enough for one day.
Jane doesn't need to license stories. She has a video camera in your house. I actually always have lots and lots of ideas. It's the writing part that's hard for me. So I don't really use other people's ideas. In fact, when I'm listening to, it's like an anecdote from somebody, I'm thinking, remember that, you'll use that. And then I come back and all I remembered was the part where I said, remember that.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, let's thank these two wonderful writers, Patricia Marks, Jane Smiley. Join us upstairs.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Somebody only had half as much.
Yeah, let's do it.
The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.